Hello, I'm Lina Ormoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. Do you consider yourself a happy person? If the answer is yes, that's great. If the answer is no, guess what? Experts say being happy can make you healthier. They say the link between a person's thoughts, feelings, and behavior can affect their physical well-being. In a scientific review published in the medical journal Applied Psychology, Health and Well-being, researchers found that, among other things, happiness has some beneficial effects on cardiovascular health, immune systems, and longevity. Furthermore, happy people likely take better care of themselves, choose healthy behaviors like exercising and eating well over unhealthy people. For more insights on happiness and well-being, I spoke with Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar, co-founder of the Happiness Studies Academy. Take a listen.
Yeah, my definition of happiness includes five elements. It includes the spiritual element, the physical element, the intellectual element, the interpersonal, relational element, and finally, of course, the emotional element. And it's when we're able to integrate these five elements in our lives, spiritual, physical, intellectual, relational, and emotional, that we lead a happy, full, and fulfilling life.
But that sounds like a lot of components there. Is it ever possible to have all the five together at once?
Yes, so you're right. And the nice thing about these five elements is that they're interconnected. In other words, there is a way in through any of them. I may decide that I want to focus on my happiness through the physical channel, and then I introduce regular exercise into my life. I can decide that I want to go in through the spiritual element of happiness, and then I do meditation. And even five minutes of meditation a day can go a long way. I can choose to invest more in my relationships or to appreciate more, to be more grateful and cultivate more pleasurable emotions, or learn more and go in through the intellectual path. So going through any one of these five elements is a viable and potential path to happiness.
So can I also say that we can have happiness if we only have one or two of the elements? So we have to have five of them at all times to be considered happy or to be happy?
Well, so the first question is, what does it really mean to be happy? You know, many people ask me, so Tal, you've been in this field for 30 years, are you happy? And my answer to that is that I don't know, because I don't think there is a point before which we're unhappy, after which we are happy. In other words, it's not a binary 0-1. Rather, it's a continuum. In other words, today I'm happier than I was 30 years ago. At the same time, I certainly hope to be happier 5 years from now than I am today. It's a journey, and it's a lifelong journey that ends when life ends. And the question is, how can I become happier? And I can become happier even if I just focus on one of the five areas. Now, if I completely neglect one of those five areas, for example, completely neglect my relationships or completely neglect physical health, then of course that is going to negatively affect my happiness. But do I need to focus on all of them all the time? No, that's not possible.
It sounds more realistic then. So in general, what have you found? What makes people happy, really? Is it influenced by culture, by the country? Or are there some key factors that determine how much people are happy or how they are happy or if they're happy?
Yeah, no. So this is a very important question. You see, there are universal elements to happiness that relate to someone having been raised in New York City. And it's the same if you're raised in Nairobi or Beijing. However, at the same time, there are also cultural differences. So, you know, some cultures are more individualistic. Some cultures are more focused on achievement and accomplishment. And these, of course, go into the equation of happiness. But the fundamentals are about human beings. And a human being is a human being is a human being. For example, we all need relationships, whether you're in New York, Nairobi, or Beijing. We all need to be physically active, regardless of where you're from. We all want a sense of meaning and purpose in our lives. And these are the important elements of the science of happiness studies. Then there are the cultural differences. And then, no less important, there are also individual differences. You know, one of the things that I emphasize in all my work through the Happiness Studies Academy is on, in addition to doing research, is doing me search. So research looks at generalities. Me search looks at individual difference. What would provide me with spiritual well-being? What would provide me with emotional well-being? And that may be different from other people.
Very interesting, the me search. I guess perhaps it should start there, right? What makes me happy before I can try to make someone else happy, right?
Very much so. You know, this is a central key to leading a happy life because, for example, there's a lot of research on journaling. And people who engage in journaling, and that is me search, that is basically asking how I'm doing, what should I do more of. People who start there are not just happier, they're also in a better place from which to help others. As Carl Rogers, the famous psychologist, said, what is most personal is most general. So we start with the self and then we expand outwards to other people.
There are studies that show that there is a direct link between happiness and physical health and well-being. Can you speak on that?
Happiness is a very good medicine. People who cultivate well-being, psychological well-being in their lives, are not just happier, they're also physically healthier. I'm not a psychotherapist, a clinical psychologist, but if I were and I was seeing patients, the first question that I would ask them is, do you exercise regularly? Because if the answer was no, I would not just encourage them, I would push them to exercise. The research showing the connection between physical health and mental health is mind-boggling. In fact, regular physical exercise, as little as 3 times a week, 30 minutes each time, of jogging or walking or swimming or dancing or whatever your favorite sport is, 30 minutes 3 times a week, has the same effect on our psychological well-being as our most powerful psychiatric medication. In fact, it works in the same way, releasing norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, you know, the feel-good chemicals in the brain. So exercising is a human need. And just as we need certain vitamins or oxygen, we also need physical exercise. Unfortunately, in today's world, too many of us have the luxury of being able, and I'm saying luxury in quotations, the luxury of not moving. It's unhealthy. We need to move it, move it.
Move it indeed. Now, you are co-founder of the Happiness Studies Academy. You mentioned the academy earlier. Talk to us about what the academy is and how do you teach happiness?
So what the Happiness Studies Academy is about is answering two questions. The first question is, how can I become happier? And the second question is, how can I help others become happier? So we have students from over 60 countries around the world who come there in order to find more happiness in their lives and in order to help their coaches or their clients, if they're therapists, or their colleagues in business or their students in school. And what it is all about is identifying evidence-based, so scientific, interventions that can actually help people attain higher levels of well-being. And what we know is that if we increase levels of well-being, we also enjoy higher levels of creativity and productivity and better relationships, more overall success, as well as physical health. So there are all those benefits to increasing levels of happiness that go beyond the fact that it feels good to feel good, which of course is an important benefit.
So the Academy's mission is to lead the happiness revolution. How so?
So, you know, there are external revolutions and there are internal revolutions. We are, of course, about the internal revolution. We money, achievements, accolades, and actually happiness resides in the places that our grandmother told us about, you know, investing people. The first step for acquiring happiness is allowing in unhappiness. So expecting to lead a life that is only happy or that we're always experiencing a high, that's unrealistic. And embracing, accepting painful emotions is critical for happiness. And then we need to lead an active life. We need to lead a life where we're constantly learning new things. If we have time for meditation or other form of mindfulness practice, that is great. And most importantly, invest in our relationships. The number one predictor of happiness is quality time we spend with people we care about and who care about us.
Tal Ben-Shahar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
That was Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar, co-founder of the Happiness Studies Academy. Nigerians living in elderly care homes are getting a chance to watch their favorite musicians come alive through virtual reality, thanks to an organization focusing on therapeutic arts. Justine Moulin-Kazandian has more.
I've never even seen this VR before, but this is my first time of using it. That's why I stood up and began dance. When the music entered my brain, it changed my swagger.
You find a lot of old people getting missing, getting lost, while trying to just take a walk, and then they can't find their way back home. So with all those happening around, we need to educate people and let them know that old people are not witches. Because they have white hair does not mean they're a witch. They have lived life. They were once young, vibrant, you know, active, just like we are.
The virtual reality can help seniors to really, in place of mental health and also in the place of brain health as well, some of these elderly ones actually have dementia, which is known as memory loss as well. But what is important is that the virtual reality can help them to connect maybe with a popular musician they grew up knowing or listening to. So reliving that moment, reliving that experience and finding expression, being able to dance and move their bodies in a way that it just makes them happy in that moment.
It looked as if I was watching Richard on stage. He gave me a feeling I can never forget.
Sometimes the seniors get to experience this virtual reality and it seems that they can't get out of it. It's like they find themselves in the world, in their own world. They stay longer there, they want to stay there forever.
It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is James Barton, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Welcome back to Health Chat. Nigerian health authorities in the northeast Borno state are working hard to contain the growing cases of kidney failure among residents of the state. Scientists are investigating whether the food and water people consume are the causes of the spike. Husseina Mohammed sends this report from Maiduguri.
Here at the kidney ward of the Government General Hospital in Maiduguri, the number of patients undergoing dialysis is increasing every week as a result of the growing cases of kidney diseases. Patients with severe kidney disease are coming here 2 to 3 times a week for the dialysis, which the government offers for free because it's very expensive.
I am grateful I came in for the dialysis. I feel better whenever I come here. It's a painful illness that can affect the brain too, especially if you also have malaria. Initially, I refused to take the doctor's advice for the dialysis, but when I later agreed, the pain was significantly reduced, and the treatment is free here.
So what is causing the increase in kidney disease in Borno State? At first, health experts blame the situation on the disruption of life, especially in refugee camps where diabetics and hypertensive patients were not getting the medical attention they need. Now the experts say there are other factors and are investigating the food people are eating and the water they are drinking to see if there is a link.
The prevalence of kidney disease in Borno State is higher than that of any other state in Nigeria. In most states, the prevalence rate is between 10% and 12%, according to the research. But in Borno, it is about 14%. The pattern we are seeing in people with these conditions is some also have high blood pressure or diabetes, and there are other factors which we are investigating.
Representatives from the state government say there will be an increased effort to support kidney patients.
In addition to the funds allocated to kidney research, the Borno state government is making efforts to provide safe drinking water to the people because there the spike in kidney disease and other diseases could be linked to an issue with the water source.
In the past, kidney disease in Borno state was mainly found among adults. But now doctors say there is an increase in the number of children coming in for dialysis.
A promising antiviral delivery system developed at Northwestern University in Illinois could be a game changer in preventing and treating COVID-19 infections. VOA's Kane Farabov has more.
And latrines.
For several decades, Kelly Callahan has worked for the global nonprofit Carter Center to provide treatment and medicine to people suffering from neglected tropical diseases in some of the most remote and warmest places on the planet.
The end of the road is not where the people live. You have to go far beyond the end of the road to deliver these vaccines or these drugs. Maintaining a cold chain becomes incredibly difficult.
Callahan says complicated logistics to keep the medicines cold aren't the only obstacle. Antibody therapies are difficult to develop, expensive, and often must be administered by medical staff. Many patients also don't want to be injected with needles, as healthcare professionals know all too well. All challenges that plague healthcare providers around the world trying to administer COVID-19 vaccines.
Anything that can be done to reduce the intensity of delivery, anything that can be done to reduce the challenges in delivery will make delivery much easier.
Which is exactly what Northwestern University's Dr. Michael Jewett is trying to do.
This can revolutionize the way in which antiviral therapies could be delivered.
Dr. Jewett and his staff at Northwestern's Center for Synthetic Biology, in partnership with the University of Washington and Washington University in St. Louis, first used supercomputers to design a new protein-based antibody nasal spray. It was refined in testing on mice and delivered promising results in combating COVID-19.
What's special about the version we created is it's actually effective at neutralizing all of the variants of concern in this mouse model.
Testing showed Northwestern's nasal spray outperformed current antibody treatments with emergency use authorization status from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA. Northwestern's nasal spray maintained effectiveness for longer and also reduced the overall level of infection.
One of the special features about this antiviral therapy is that we can both treat and prevent it.
The next crucial step for the research team's nasal spray, which is cheaper to manufacture, doesn't require cold storage, and can be self-administered, is determining its effectiveness in humans.
We've currently partnered with a biomanufacturing company to scale up the synthesis for testing and ultimately moving this towards phase one clinical trials.
Jewett says the process his team developed could be valuable in the fight against future pandemics.
So I do think that all of the elements of the kind of platform that we've been able to put in place could be repurposed towards future viruses that we might face.
This could be a game changer for many different types of treatments, not just one particular disease. It could be for multiple diseases.
Clinical trials for the COVID-19 nasal spray could begin by the end of the year. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Evanston, Illinois.
Drought is not new to the Horn of Africa, but experts say the record one killing crops and cattle across Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia has underscored the increasing frequency of drought due to climate change. In Ethiopia, the UN's World Food Program is not just feeding those affected, but also working to help drought-proof communities for the longer term. Linda Givertesh reports from Kodi, Ethiopia.
Hawu Abdi Wale has lived through many droughts in her 70 years of life. But until now, she says she's never seen four consecutive rainy seasons fail. Wale says she has seen a big difference. In her early years, she says people used to see more rains and animals produce more milk. There is a big, big difference. The World Food Program is helping her village not only survive the crisis, but rebuild for the long term. They're digging meter-wide semicircle holes in the barren soil to capture runoff water when rains return so that grass can grow more effectively and feed their surviving livestock. Forward-looking interventions are desperately needed. Scientists say climate change is the culprit for these more frequent, severe conditions. Abubakar Saleh Babakar is with the World Meteorological Organization in Ethiopia.
The climate in this region is driven by what is happening in the neighboring ocean. There are studies that indicate that this is the fastest warming part of the tropical ocean system. So it is warming rapidly during the past 100 years. And this warming, as I said, it is associated with the dryness of the marsh June season.
It also results in flooding when the rain does return. These events aren't just examples of climate change, but inequality. Haptamu Adam is a climate policy expert in Addis Ababa.
When you compare from the emission level from our contribution to the climate change, it is very incomparable because most of the emissions are emitted from developed countries.
Yet developing countries like Ethiopia don't have the funds to fight the effects. The World Meteorological Organization estimates that sub-Saharan Africa will need up to $50 billion annually to adapt to climate change. Without it, the number of people displaced and in need of aid will only continue to rise. Ali Hussein is with the World Food Program in the Somali region.
We need to build the community resistance to these shocks. And in that line, we want to put more emphasis on these regreening activities, such as half moons, to regenerate this dry desert area to become a green land in the future, which can be more useful to both communities and as well as livestock.
These projects around the Somali region are showing success and could be replicated to help more people. Ibrahim Korbad Farah is an elder of a village that saw its land restored with the construction of a channel that is effectively diverting streams and rainwater. He says they've experienced numerous advantages. They're now able to farm and use the grass for livestock, as well as thatches for their houses. He says they also use the water for drinking, especially for the livestock. While adaptation is crucial to communities' health and survival, climate scientists warn reducing emissions remains a priority in preventing even worse conditions in the future. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Gode, Ethiopia.
In Abidjan, the economic capital of Côte d'Ivoire, a hospital is experimenting with a different method which makes it possible to fight more effectively against the infant mortality of premature babies, a serious problem in the West African country. Thanks to the kangaroo mother method, premature children stay connected to the natural warmth of their mother, an approach inspired by the Australian animal. Yassine Siyo has the story.
For this 40-year-old mother, the last 2 weeks have been trying. On her arrival in this somewhat unusual unit, her daughter, Ouma, weighed only 1.44 kilograms. But thanks to the care provided and especially to the mother kangaroo method, the infant, constantly stuck to her mother's chest, gained some 300 grams. Today, her days are no longer in danger and the mother can finally breathe a big sigh of relief.
The child is doing better. She evolves easily, but it did me good. I feel better. I know that when I get out of here, the child is going to live. He will be better. And I learned a lot of things about premature babies.
Studies show that this kangaroo method or skin-to-skin method of holding the baby to your chest enables healthier development of premature babies. The infant sleeps better and does not feel the stress that an incubator can cause.
We're like a family here. Each watches over the other. Each ensures that the rules here are applied. That is, carry the child in the kangaroo for all activities except going to the toilet. We hold each other accountable.
Dr. Somi Miazu is the head of the kangaroo mother care unit at Trecheville Hospital. He trained in South Africa on this particular method and estimates that before the opening of the unit, babies weighing less than 1 kilogram would systematically die, and while those weighing 1.5 kilograms had very little chance of surviving.
Beyond survival, there is the bond between mother and child. The child was born premature. The mother was not prepared to receive at that moment. And the child was not ready to come out, so she has a fear inside her, afraid to carry them. So putting him on her chest reassures her.
This approach also makes it possible to change society as a whole.
The third advantage that we can cite is the stigma of premature babies. We don't give them a name because we are not sure they will survive. They are left to their own devices. The family who didn't believe in this at all sees that the child can live, so it changes the negative views they may have.
The doctor says the Trechville University Hospital, the next extension of the center, also provides a space to train healthcare workers in Ivory Coast and neighboring countries.
A mechanical engineering professor at the University of Texas, Austin, is creating robots that are not visible to the naked eye, with the goal that one day they will work as an autonomous team treating tumors in the human
system. A mechanical engineering professor at the University of Texas at Austin is working with his team to create tiny robots, substantially smaller than the tip of a pen, that will swim through the human body and autonomously repair problems like a cancerous tumor.
Hopefully one day they can get into our body and can do surgery or detect where those tumor cells are, so it can be non-invasive therapy for us.
This may sound like science fiction, but scientists worldwide are working to make it a reality. These robots enter the body through an injection or by swallowing them. Once given a target like a tumor, Zhang says they will communicate with each other to work collectively to achieve a goal. Some researchers use ultrasound waves or chemical reactions to move the nanobots. Zhang's team is using optics, light in the form of a high-powered laser beam, to manipulate the tiny robots, which are made of gold, silicon, and polystyrene. Zhang's goal is for the micro-nano robots, as he calls them, to learn to work together, much like a school of fish.
How can we make a lot of these different type of micro robots start to have interaction, so they can form a group of behavior, a coordinated behavior?
Zhang compared the robots to self-driving cars that have a destination but must learn the rules of the road and the dangers.
For them is to try to avoid the traffic of the immune system in the body.
And the future roles of the micro-nano robots will not be limited to the human body. Zhang says they might one day be placed in a lake to swim around and clean up pollutants. Clinical studies in humans are scheduled to begin in the next few years, so it may not be too long before nanorobots are performing surgeries from within. Dina Mitchell for VOA News, Austin, Texas.
That's it for this edition of Health Chat. Check us out at facebook.com/VOA Health Chat and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu, in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care and strive to make every day a healthy day.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.